Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of Security Nation, the podcast where we talk to interesting people doing cool things to advance security in some way. I feel like sometimes I say cool people doing interesting things, and sometimes the other way around. That's how fresh that intro gets.
Sometimes interesting people with cool things.
It is. That's it. It's like, ooh, which way around will those words be?
It's called A-B testing. Jen, you used to be in marketing. You know what this is.
hush your mouth. I feel like I need to like get a thesaurus and like try some other words than cool and interesting. So I'm your host. Your very limited vocabulary host, Jen Ellis, Rapid7's VP of Community and Public Affairs. And with me, as you already heard, is my amazing co-host, Todd Bisley. I think
Hello.
Amazing is probably how I always describe you as well.
Pretty much
how
always,
about
yes.
Debonair. My debonair.
Perfect.
Co-host.
I love it. I'm feeling pretty debonair.
I feel like today's guest, what adjective would I use for him?
Oh, boy.
I mean, firstly, his mutton chops deserve their very own superlative.
Yes.
Which now people are going to be like, is it Dan Gere? It's not Dan Gere. I'm sorry, no. Guys. It's the other guy in security with amazing mutton chops. Right. It's Art Mannion. Art, we're so happy to have you.
Hello.
So for those who don't know, Art is the Vulnerability Analysis Technical Manager at CERT, Coordination Center, or CERT-CC, as we in the biz say, which is part of the Software Engineering Institute at Carnegie Mellon University. That, my friends, may be the longest title string we've ever had to do for a guest. Maybe we could make this into a thing. We could try and like recruit more people who have absurdly long title strings. Anyway, Art, it is a true pleasure to have you on, despite your absurdly long title string. How are you doing?
No, I'm doing great. It is a pleasure to be here. It's great to hear your voices. Yeah, looking forward to it. Yeah.
So a lot of people have been growing COVID beards.
Yes. I am one of them. Yes.
Really? Yes. So the mutton chops are currently filled in. They've joined.
Yeah, they are hard to see on a webcam anymore, probably in person as well.
Wow.
But the next important customer meeting or wedding or funeral, they will be coming back. So,
yeah, like, yeah. Dude, this is your personal brand. You can't mess with this.
It'll be back. It's just a matter. It's honestly mostly just laziness and lack of need. But they'll be back. Don't worry. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I hope so.
Okay.
And for those of you not familiar, you know, there should be a photo of Art that accompanies the podcast. So it'll be his pre-COVID photo, right, where you'll be able to see the magnificence that is his mutton chops. All right. So Art, what are you going to talk to us about today? I think you're going to talk about Vince. Is this right? Before we get into it, actually, we should probably talk a little bit about what CERT-CC is, what you guys do.
Sure. No, CERT-CC goes back 30 years, pretty much, which in internet time is a long time.
It's practically all of the time.
It's almost all of the time. I mean, really, it's getting back to the days. My rough understanding of the original cast of CERT-CC was one person, possibly part time, who may have had the ability to call or email all the people who ran the internet at the time, almost. So it goes back pretty far.
Let's get that person on the phone sometime.
He is probably happily retired and spending his time fishing. Yes, like properly.
And like
fishing.
Totally unwilling to answer the phone to anyone who wants to talk about stuff.
He's a wise man. I suspect he is out. Yeah. So, so I can tell stories about him being able to reach everybody personally on the internet. And this goes back to, and here's the fun part of the story. There was the relatively at the time famous Morris worm, which ran around and exploited, guess what, surprise, vulnerabilities in internet-facing software that were not patched. And the CERT Coordination Center's first public posting advisory was about, hey, go and fix your internet-facing things, which were like SendMail and FTP at the time. And 30 years later, we are still doing the same work.
Still sending that email, huh?
Yes.
Have you, like, at least changed the font of the email?
Well, we've, over the years, progressed from fixed-width plain text to web pages, these things called web pages with dynamic fonts. I think you download from a third-party site. And, so, and graphics, there's some colors involved, I understand. So we're getting better with the presentation. And in fact, it's a great lead-in because Vince, this thing we're calling Vince, is the next phase in the evolution of how we talk to the rest of the world about vulnerabilities. And
look at how you smoothly transitioned that and set it
up. You set me up so nicely. Thank you.
You are such a pro. Amazing. Hey,
set up. Yes.
So it's named after Vince Vaughn, right?
Named after Vince Vaughn. And it's in fact, and I had to had to remember it. Sorry, it is the we're backronym happy. So this is the Vulnerability Information and Coordination Environment. And I owe a colleague who has moved on something, a beer or a smack for that backronym. But it works well. We get to call it Vince. There's something short, great for DNS and websites and things. So But this is really, for decades and decades, as we discussed, like with the PGP signed email and the fixed width text, we are moving to a web-based platform to do not only the advisory publication, but all of the what leads up to the advisory publication. And some folks see this and some folks don't, is often a lot of sort of private, non-public, back and forth, secret activity, private vulnerability coordination that goes on before the advisories and the announcements and the CVEs come out. So Vince is a platform to do that work. And we are trying to move away from a number of things, including email as the sort of transport mechanism for all this communication.
Oh my God, that's going to make Todd happy because he is not a fan of email.
Well, I'm not a fan of email, and I'm especially not a fan of PGP.
Yes.
I am a fan of getting receipts for things. Not like read receipts, like the Outlook version of read receipts. But I do like having timestamps on things. And I don't want to steal your thunder here, Art, but I am a beta user of Vince. that was one of my items of feedback is like I need dates like sprinkled everywhere. Like I want to know like when things happened, mainly so I could prove it to other people. And because my memory is horrible and I don't want to like keep, you know, paper notes anymore, but I still do.
Plus one, all of that.
Well, yeah, and actually those are great points. We've
and it does now.
Yeah, well, and we struggled with there are trade-offs, right? So yes, Todd, PGP email. I occasionally feel like getting into the fray when someone says on Twitter that PGP is hard, and I want to say, look, I can use it successfully, but it doesn't scale at all, and it is hard.
Yeah,
they really are right.
That'd be such a bullshit response. PGP's hard. Well, I can use it. Bye.
Yeah, yeah. After decades of effing it up, I mean, it is hard, and it's hard at scale.
After you've made every mistake possible, which PGP is more than happy to let you do.
It is. So, okay. So I'm going to agree that PGP email as a transport at scale is hard and almost ridiculous. So I get it. Email is nice because it's a transaction log though. We have decades of cert at cert.org emails stored. My colleague can mine it for data. It's got timestamps. It's a great transaction log. Todd, I expect that we have your feedback noted somewhere in an issue, and I suspect we're doing something about it, but I don't have the answer directly at my fingertips. So
this is not the Todd Beardsley Vince feedback session.
Well,
Why are we doing that? We
got a bunch of feedback in February, March before quarantine happened, and we're taking it seriously. We've made a bunch of changes, and part of the release events will be noting some of those changes we made. But anyway, understood point. And this is actually, Todd, again, a great setup. Moving from email to web platforms has some drawbacks. And a common communications channel is one of those issues. Vince is its own custom web portal.
Yeah.
What if we all had our own custom web portals for vulnerability coordination?
Oh, that kind of sucks, huh?
Yeah. We'd all have to have our own, you know, human interface with every different coordination platforms. I'm not sure how that's going to scale. Actually.
I have a feature request.
Yes, please.
it is actually the Vince beta program podcast. So yeah. Here's the feature request is that like, why not dump all communications back at like in the back end, like back to cert@cert.org, and that way you can continue on with your mining.
We are planning to do some of that, and maybe more. That's a great point. Thank you. But we're trying to look at this. So, you know, we have our own operational service to take care of, right? Our own coordination service to take care of. But we are finding we talk a lot with the vendors and developers who are going to end up being responsible for creating the bugs and for fixing them, right? So we talk to product security teams or pcerts a lot, and we're seeing motion there to move to their own platforms and ticket tracking platforms as well. Some off-the-shelf stuff, some custom stuff. So we're noticing that this is, you know, how are we going to scale in a post-email world? We are hoping that perhaps the dream of a common API might be a useful approach here. So along with sort of email tracking as a transaction log, Vince will support an API, and it is our hope to work that out by testing in production and figure out if there is interest and viability in a common API, because we really don't want to scale to, you know, dozens or even low hundreds of vendors and coordinators and researchers all with their own custom web platform. It won't work well.
And I know that you're like a standards API kind of guy. I mean, I assume like you've looked at, things like Veris, right? For something, you know, something like that, maybe. For having this common API language, because like the moment you said that, I just had visions of like Attacker KB, which is like a Rapid7 project, talking to Vince and Vince talking to Attacker KB and like having their own like machine conversations. And wouldn't that be a wonderful world?
We again, the vision is yes, machines talking to machines. It is excellent standards practice to first look around and see what already exists before making a new one. Did you say Veris?
I did.
Okay. Noted. Thank you. we will do that. But, again, this is a, you know, it's an issue for directly ourselves for Vince, but, as you know, CertCC is, we are self-mandated and directed by our primary sponsor, CISA, part of DHS, to make the community better, right? Make the vulnerability coordination and vulnerability management ecosystem work better. So it's not just about us having our platform be awesome. It is about helping everybody else work better together, reduce friction. So this idea of how do we all speak together, a common API is part of the bigger picture. It's not just to make Vince work well. So
and the things that you cover are, you know, is your mandate. Like your primary goal here, right, is coordination. It's in the name. Whereas I can imagine an API that is common between like NVD, CVE, AttackerKB, and Vince, right? But they all have different goals.
Yeah.
So you'd have different, you know, you'd have different argots and dialects of kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. Let's design it right now, Art. This is all I want to do today.
Yeah. This is the most active I've heard Todd be on a podcast for ages.
It's a great visionary idea, but the problem, you know, it's a vision, so you have to actually try to do it, and then it gets to be a slog. So, yeah. But
well, so far, I've been delighted with the Vince experience.
To hear.
It was just going through the beta program was great. It seems like you have really good people working on it, so I'm excited to start giving you bad news over it.
I am also excited and a little nervous. We are trying to pin down a May go live date.
Oh wow!
So as I type dates and email to people, I'm feeling both excited and nervous. It's a big rollout, and it turns out we are not. We're not a regular software development shop, so we're proceeding very cautiously. So,
well, there's some weird stuff going on at the moment in the world. I don't know if you've heard.
There is. But I think I think that's going to not block us, but it is, you know, making things more interesting, certainly.
And you are an unusual software development shop, right? Like you don't super care about having most, you know, minimum viable product out first. Like security does. I would hope that security comes first over in CertCC land.
Yeah, we've been doing as much sort of security dog fooding as possible. We have some highly skilled researchers on our team who we have thrown at our software. And we actually have a peer team that does sort of assessments and penetration tests that we're going to also try to sort of throw at events. And, you know, we will be very mature about the fact that the odds are in favor of us releasing software with, get this, a security bug somewhere in it. And when that, if and when that happens, we will be a good vendor and fix it quickly and be transparent about what happened and do our best to thank and give credit to the person who found it and told us nicely, hopefully.
It's so meta.
It is meta, but it's a thing. You gotta, if we're gonna go out saying stuff, we have to live the example. Otherwise, it would be key. It would be supreme hypocrisy.
Wow,
otherwise,
not the thing that people do. Yeah, right. Yeah. That's so fashionable.
I think our mandate is to not hypocrisy is part of our mandate. Maybe anyway.
Is that how it's worded? Not hypocrisy.
That's in the contract.
Do you have
it
on stickers? Like, is that
not hypocrisy? we don't.
That's a good
idea. That's
not the kind of poc you like. Hey.
Yes. Okay. We're very excited. I appreciate the nod, Todd. So yeah.
So what's the process? So like one, you know, what was it that made you guys all be like, this is a thing we must do and we must do it now?
It's been, the idea has been floating around for years. I think the culmination of things and, you know, not to get too deep into our internal processes, but having highly qualified development resources available, and having some internal things line up priority wise was a big part of it. We've taken a couple of starting runs at this problem over the years, but it's a big project. And I have as Todd already mentioned, I've got a great, great, great team and great development team here. So that's really been key to getting this working now. Also, we got a lot of mileage out of our old platform, but it was 20 years old and great investment, great return on investment, but getting dated. Really old Perl code, some other stuff that was getting fragile, long in the tooth, hard to support. So, you know, normal software development things, the life cycle had kind of ended on that sucker, and time to move on. And again, right, if we're going to be a leader in this space by any means, it was also time, right? We're seeing, you know, the bug bounty platforms, people using normal commodity ticketing systems, adapting them for coordinated disclosure.
Right.
Other custom builds going out. It's time to sort of get with what's going on and try to figure out, again, what are the interoperability at scale problems that this is going to cause? Like the, right, how do we all interface with our respective services? It's not humans sending email anymore. It's machines trying to read APIs or something.
So once you made the decision, what has your process been? Obviously, you have some sort of beta running right now.
We do, yeah. So we've got a, I'd say, a very small beta running.
Do you hear that, Todd? That you are special.
I know.
Todd is special.
This is not news.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make sure you were aware. I'm sorry.
Todd is one of our special beta users.
He is a very special beta user. Yeah.
I want a button. For my denim jacket.
I feel like we can make this happen.
How about a patch?
Perfect. I love
button.
It.
Okay. We had the first beta was sort of February, and we got a bunch of feedback. Todd was mentioning we did some usability testing and UX testing. We got in front of our, you know, one of the biggest user groups for us is the vendors and the PCert teams. So we got in front of them a couple times in February and late March. Collected a lot of feedback, have made some changes based on that feedback, basically been working through those things since then. And again, looking at May here. So,
and have there been any things that were like big flags or like real big learnings that came out of this?
There's a big flag. There's at least one big flag, and we pretty much expected this. There's the Vince platform and the technology basically implements a shift in coordination dynamics. So with email, the CERT coordination center was sort of a, if you're a network topology person, you can imagine a hub and spoke. So, you know, a researcher sends email to CERT and we decrypt that and process it. And then we read it. And if there's something that needs to be done, we send that out onto the vendor or multiple vendors. Or we do a back and forth with the researcher, refine the message, and then send that to the vendor. So, you know, CERT CC is the moderator of all of the email comms going between, you know, usually one researcher, sometimes more, and one or more vendors. And this is nice because we can moderate and tune messages and, you know, extract, you know, delete superfluous things and let the objective text stuff go through when needed. On the other hand, we're the blocker, right? If the analyst is busy and has 10 cases or is out for a week and we transfer it and someone's behind, we slow things down. So Vince implements a bit more of a bus topology where all of the participants in a case have, among other ways to communicate, they have a common case chat or a case room where everybody in the case, all the vendors, all the researchers can see what's going on in the common room. So in this case, the moderation is basically removed because the CERT Coordination Center is not going to be in the middle of a message, allowing it to go through or not. On the other hand, as soon as the message is sent, everybody in the case sees it, and we're not slowing things down. So that's a major shift, and there, understandably, was some feedback from the vendor community about, you know, researchers sort of seeing all of the otherwise sort of private comms that's going on. It's our pretty strong position these days that we are going to assume sort of good behavior and professionalism and benevolence on all parts of all parties, and let's open this up and have this out. And if someone's misbehaving, there will be some discussions about that. But we want to remove ourselves from the blocking position and encourage, you know, a norm where everyone's talking, getting along, getting the things fixed and going about their business. And we're not in the middle of it and sort of closing the sometimes real and sometimes perhaps imagined researcher and vendor gap.
And I think like that sounds like a pretty reasonable reflection of the change, the maturing of the culture around this and the maturing of the understanding and like, you know, on both sides, right? Like that there should be a greater expectation of open collaboration on both sides and both parties coming to the table prepared and expecting that to be part of the process.
Yeah, and that's, we're, you know, it's not just technology. We're trying to advance the sort of the norms and the practice. And I know sure, you guys in Rapid7 have right. been behind this for many years and great supporters of the community, you know, beyond just what Rapid7 does for business.
Oh, shucks.
No, really. It's entirely true, and I am saying it out loud. thank you both, and thank you, Rapid7, for your the community aspects of your work.
Oh, this is great. You can come on anytime.
Yeah. I can. Hey, I call it like I see it. It's for real. But right. Again, mandate is not just do a good job of our own hamster wheel, but make things better. And, you know, we want vulnerability coordination and reporting to be kind of mundane and boring. And it's going to stay exciting. Don't worry. but you know, we want it to be normal.
No, but it needs to get to a business as usual point of view.
Right.
I agree. That doesn't mean not prioritized.
Correct.
But it means not panicked and hysterical. I totally get that. Yeah.
Yes. So this is sometimes perhaps not obvious to people, but all software has bugs, and some of those are security bugs.
What?
It's rain. The rain will fall. The sun will rise. Software has bugs. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Don't sweat it. What are you doing about your bugs? That's what we're going to focus on. Not that you have them. You are forgiven for developing software with bugs. Please pay attention to your response to the security bugs. That's it. Anyway.
So like the downside here though is I'm sure you've seen this a mile away of if you're no longer moderating, like you are going to run into a case where a hacker is going to be threatening a vendor and a vendor is going to be threatening a hacker. And then things escalate like crazy quick, especially if they're both in weird time zones.
Yeah.
So is there, I assume you have some kind of backstop for this, like you can swoop in and moderate or something or what?
So the plan is one of the changes we made post that the first big round of feedback is, there is the ability to have we can set up a private channel within a case. And of course there are always outside events back channels, right? Where despite the fact that I'm saying, you know, PGP email is dead, we just made bug fixes to our PGP email system because it's not really going to go completely away. And you know, I'm interested also in, right, if there's a common discussion and someone is behaving questionably, I plan to go in there and, you know, we will use the tools at our disposal, but there's a private chat feature. We can go out of band. We can say something in the group about someone's behavior and professionalism, or we can try it privately. And, you know, worst case, this is a social construct, right? If I misbehave in the group doesn't want me there next time. That's kind of where this leads to if it comes to that level of action.
So it's in the interest of, you know, vendors of software to behave themselves, right? Or else they're
likewise
just,
for researchers.
Right, exactly. Researchers too. Like
both, if, yes.
Yeah, I mean, there is a power imbalance there.
There is.
Because it seems like the power does rest with badly behaving researchers cost more, I'd say, than badly behaving vendors. Like badly behaving vendors don't get bug reports anymore, right? Like that's kind of the ultimate, that's kind of the end state. Like if you're just not responsive and you're threatening and all that, like it's much better than to just never report bugs because, you know, why would you bring that? Why would you bring that heartache upon yourself? Whereas like a badly behaving researcher who shows up and says like, this is, you know, if you don't act in a day, then I'm going to drop this on Twitter. It's like, well, I mean, that is kind of the ultimate, you know, that seems to be the end state, right? You know, not considering the fact that like, you're going to have researchers come in that don't have actual, like they're going to report a thing that's a bug. That's not really a bug. Maybe it's a feature. Maybe it's like something you can configure around or whatever. But yeah, it's like, I feel like badly behaving vendors have more to lose.
I think that's right. I think that unless you have broken the law in some way, which don't do that. But unless you've broken the law in some way, then the researcher really just has their patience to lose. Probably. Although actually we have stories of people who've lost jobs and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I think that the bottom line is, if as a researcher what you care about is seeing the thing fixed and seeing people protected, like if you care about security, right, that's your end state that you want to get to is improved security, then it behooves you as a researcher to also behave appropriately, because if you don't, then the vendor is much more likely not to.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you need to, like, building trust is a two-way street.
It is.
It's a two-way process. You have to, like, not just meet people in the middle, but almost, like, overcompensate to say to them, because you have to recognize that what you're doing is a situation that creates defensiveness. It just is. And to Art's point, hopefully one day it won't be, but for today, it definitely is. And so, you know, you have to kind of have a little empathy there.
And it's adversarial, but adversarial systems are sometimes okay, right? Like we have lots of adversarial systems that we need. And, you know, it's like the US court system is an adversarial system and we need it. And so I imagine that there will be a future where like bugs are boring, like Art said, and, you know, it's just kind of a matter of course. There will, I think, always be an element of adversary in that. And it's just up to everybody to just kind of, you know, grow up and be mature.
You're both, of course, spot on. And it's okay for it to be inherently an adversarial system, but everyone, you know, the mature players understand that despite that, there's an etiquette, there's a protocol, there's a norm. And here's what I've sort of looked at over the years. Even for a vendor, if you want to imagine the most sort of venal, bottom line focused commercial vendor you could possibly imagine with the most lawyers possible, it is less. Uh-huh. It is just an imaginary hypothetical vendor. I'm not any specific one. Imagine a hypothetical situation like this. And here's my message to that imaginary hypothetical organization: you will save money/make money. It is cheaper for you to be cooperative in this process than it is to be adversarial.
Boy, I sure want science on that too. Do you have that?
Boy.
Does anyone have that? Like, this is an MIT research paper.
I don't have science, but I will say it as an opinion as loudly as I can. Yeah.
Has Katie never published anything on that? I feel like she has.
Oh, you know.
And actually, we should give a shout out, because, like, I feel like any conversation around this sort of stuff, without referencing your partner in crime, your co-conspirator, Katie Mazuris, who isn't part of the aforementioned CERT-CC, Software Engineering Institute of Carnegie Mellon University, But instead, as the CEO of the founder and CEO of Luta Security, hi Katie, we're hoping you'll come on in a couple of weeks. But I think she in the past may have published some data on this stuff.
Yeah, she may have. And basically, I'm very aware of her work, but it's a matter of you have to read it and get into the details or have an update chat with Katie about it. Yeah, yeah.
It may not be up to date anymore. But
I know she's done stuff on like crossover of like discovered bugs versus like bugs that were in the wild and all of that, like, and it's good research. What I'm after is like dollar costs. Like I want like an actuary table kind of thing of like,
right. versus, we do not have
suppressing it. A bug versus fixing a bug. Like what are the cost differences?
I will claim expert opinion, but right. Someone like Katie, who of course had spent time at a large company's PCert team and probably knows what the internal costs look like. You know, I have seen large commercial companies, PCert teams, move to more cooperative behavior. I highly suspect that those for-profit companies figured out the bottom line on this.
I can't imagine they do it just like...
No, they don't. They do it because of saving the money. It has to be.
Right. It's got to be.
So remember, even if you don't like the situation you're in, it's cheaper. So if nothing else, please do it for that reason. We'd like you to be nice. Also, please be nice people.
Just
but, right?
Feel free to just be cheap, though. I like that as a
sure,
message.
Sure.
That's great.
Oh, actually, this touches on another item that if you don't mind, very mild, mild topic switch. But this kind of goes back to if we are all going to have our own websites and web platforms, and we all have our own interfaces to these things, and how do we all communicate at scale, right? Beyond, you know, one researcher and one vendor exchanging button clicks on each other's websites. Email, you know, at the bottom of email, there's sometimes a long paragraph about you have to delete it and your lawyer said something and whatever. But email's sort of email, and I'm sure there's some legal ish around stuff around email that I probably don't know what it is and don't listen to it. But email's a thing. But then when I go to a website and maybe I sign up for a free account, I have probably clicked through some terms of service. And when I click submit on the vulnerability report form, there's probably some terms there. And these can be, you know, it's one thing if I'm signing up for a bug bounty, right? And I am agreeing to, for example, cede to the vendor the authority to decide when to go public in exchange for money, right? That's an exchange. And I read the terms up front as a researcher and I agree to those terms. And I've got a contract and like an actual contract with the vendor. And in exchange for something, I'm going to give them the bug report and behave a certain way, all well and good. When you sort of step away from that a little bit and take away the compensation, you know, those terms are a little bit less enticing. For instance, what if the terms were the vendor decides when to go public and in exchange for that, nothing, or we might put your name in the advisory. So there's a specific term here about, you know, sort of what things a researcher might sign away in exchange for the other half of the contract. But even beyond that specific type of term, how does a researcher or a research organization or a coordinator parse and track down and decide in advance if they're going to agree to all of the terms on all of the web platforms where they're going to be trying to talk to people? And just collecting the terms is a mess because the terms point to other terms, and they're all written. And how do I parse them all, right? So there's a scale problem, like the interface to the website. There's the sort of interface to the policy and the terms problem at scale, and then there are the actual terms themselves. And we're seeing a little bit. We're hoping it's edge case stuff so far, but we're seeing this example where, hey, someone built a website, and while we're at it, why don't we ask the submitter to agree to some terms that we like? For instance, don't disclose unless we say so. And we're seeing a little bit of pushback in a couple of cases on why would I agree to that in advance when I could just, you know, put it on Twitter or post it or not report at all. And this gets back to your point, Todd. If the vendor is going to be a little firm about some of their terms, you very quickly push researchers to your options are at a high level. Tell the vendor in advance, tell no one, drop it publicly, maybe sell it to someone, right? The vendor, one of those options is good for the vendor. The others are all not as good. So don't push researchers to not disclose or to go public. Anyway, terms, legalese, disclosure process, web submission form terms at scale are a problem, and slippery terms about giving too much control to one of the parties are a problem also.
And if only we had some kind of common disclosure set of terms out there.
Once again.
But we do. It's called Disclosure.io. And
yeah.
That is, I think that's a Bug Crowd thing or a Casey Ellis thing or both of those things.
Disclose.io.
Disclose.io.
Disclose.io. I am going to register disclosure.io right now if it is.
if you want to know more about it, we chatted with Casey just a few weeks ago. So there is.
If you scroll back, I think four episodes, mention. I think it is. Yeah. Maybe five.
And so, yeah, so definitely check it out. So what is the key takeaway that you want people to have on Vince, other than that Todd is special, obviously?
Mm-hmm. Todd is one of the special people. Right. But yes, I think a lot of us know that and appreciate it. If you do coordinated disclosure business with CERT, the times are a-changing. There's a new platform coming and you can set aside your PGP email and you can get out your two-factor auth and your web interfaces, and we'd be happy to talk and test API with you. There's a bit of a shift in the coordination communications paradigm where everyone's going to see each other in the same common room. And those are the big shifts. And I guess, you know, that's going to change your interfacing with us. But we are very interested in, again, doing this at scale. As everyone else moves to a platform, how do we all manage to talk to each other and interpret each other's terms at scale so that we're not hung up with having to click on 50 different websites for 50 different vendors for a vulnerability report?
Awesome.
Good luck.
Yeah. Firstly, as you said, good luck. Good luck. And, you know, thank you not just for coming on and talking to us about it, but thank you for everything you do on this. You've been at CERT for a very long time. And working sort of tirelessly, or maybe you're like, no, it hasn't been tirelessly. I'm exhausted on vulnerability disclosure. And you are very active in the security research community, helping people understand the process and advocating for better processes and better understanding and better compassion. So we are super grateful to you for what you do and your efforts on the ISOs and of course your mutton chops.
I do what I can, including the appearances. So yeah, thank you. And again, yeah, thanks for having me on. It's great to have a chance to chat about Vince, and we'll be doing some, you know, with the SEI and with CERT as well. But great to have a chance to reach your audience as well. So thanks.
Oh, thank you so much again. Oh, it was so good to have you on. And speaking of vulnerabilities, Mr. Beardsley, yeah, what's happening in vulnerability land?
Speaking of vulnerabilities that CERT has been involved in, even. So all the InfoSec Twitter is all a Twitter about the Ripple 20 vulnerabilities.
It sounds like an ice cream flavor.
It is almost as good as ice cream.
No, I don't believe hunters. You.
Oh, they're good. So first off, confusingly, there are 19 vulnerabilities described in Ripple 20.
Does the 20 refer to the year, though?
That's it does.
Thing. It does. Look at that.
Which took me a second to figure that out. But this is a set of vulnerabilities discovered, validated, and disclosed by a group called the JSOF Research Lab, or JSOF. I'm not super sure how they pronounce it. I've never heard anyone say their name aloud, but they're legit. And they found two heaping handfuls of vulnerabilities in some pretty core networking libraries.
Is that, just to be clear, is that how we measure vulnerabilities
right
now, is in handfuls?
Yes. Okay, that's right. Heaping handfuls. So like a handful is maybe seven, a heaping handful is 10. This
nice.
Is two heaping handfuls. So
this is good. This is good for people to know.
Uh-huh. And so these bugs, they all revolve around a set of network library code produced by a company called Trek. They're a company out of Ohio. As far as I know, no one has ever heard of Trek before, except for, I guess, the people who work there and the people that work with, because they work apparently with everyone.
They provide a lot of the basically the TCP IP nuts and bolts to a bunch of IoT gear, industrial gear, OT gear, anything that's not really a computer, right? So they do like real time TCP IP networking. They were founded in 1997, and their code has been, shipped and reshipped and repackaged. And it was like this whole.
It sounds like Heartbleed all over again. Like no one was paying attention, but everybody was using it.
You know what? It kind of is. Because like you have, little tiny boutique companies that make like their one infusion pump, and that's it. And they use this thing. And then you have other companies like Cisco and HP that also use this stuff, right? So it's the entire range here. And so like these guys are real InfoSec heroes because they started this research back in September of 2019. And they found they were just like pulling apart IoT devices. We do the same thing here at Rapid7. We're like, oh, let's look at this like class of IoT device and pull them apart and see what happens. They found a couple vulnerabilities and then they've noticed they could have just stopped there, right? Find a couple of vulnerabilities, publish it on whatever the gear that was, move on with their lives, right? But they didn't. They took that next step, that next very fraught step of like, well, this stack is written by some third party, not by, this manufacturer. I wonder what else they're in. And it turns out everything. It turns out it's in a ton of stuff. So they contact Trek. Trek has never been mentioned in any of the security literature. They're not like a common, it's not like VxWorks or OpenWRT, it's not anything like that. It's just like this kind of custom, library that's good for low resource devices. So they track this down all over the place. And then, so they talk to Trek. And Trek's like, what are you talking about? Because they've never had a security vulnerability reporter, discover or come to them before. Mm-hmm. They've never had a disclosure program, anything like that. So they say, okay, and then they work it out, and it's the normal thing. They gave them 90 days and a couple extensions. Trek came up with some patches about 45 days in, which is pretty normal, right?
Yep.
But then it came to like notifying everyone and actually getting these patches out. And that was why we're talking about this here in June of 2020 and not way back in like December of 2019. So they ended up coordinating, Trek and JSOF partnered up and ended up coordinating with basically everyone. CERT, CISA, ICS CERT, Intel, Cisco, HP, everyone who has a vulnerability disclosure program or is involved in vulnerability disclosure was involved in this. So it ends up being a pretty great story for at least as far as disclosure goes, because now if you go to the Trek's website, they have a whole thing like report a vulnerability here and here's the current ones and here's all the stuff.
Yeah.
And it looks like they've been doing it forever, right? Like it feels very professional the way they have it now. And they've only been at this for like a couple months. So
it's a bravo to them for learning through the process.
Right. And like, and not suing anyone and not being jerks about it and not like issuing statements after the fact saying like, oh, this is all irresponsible, which some people do still.
Yes.
Or just not ignoring it, and like leaving it all on JSOF to like do all this coordination. Like they appear to be, have been involved like all along the way. So it's a really great vulnerability disclosure story. The vulnerabilities themselves are bad. they are, I've mentioned this before and I might like climb back up on this soapbox again. Like if you want to find vulnerabilities in core like networking protocols, read the RFC, read where they are defined and then implement that and you will find a bug in somebody. Because there's like lots of goofy things that happen in the course of real networking, right? Like we have, there's this whole mechanism of doing like IP fragmentation, which doesn't really happen in the real world. But the spec was written at a time where didn't really know like what networks were going to look like in the future. So maybe we'd have different networks with like different, fatness of their cables. And so like, you can't put through a normal IP, a normal IP packet. So you have to break it up into multiple packets. Well, this doesn't really normally happen in the real world, but this is a great place where it's It's the kind of code where it anticipates a problem, it tries to solve the problem. You know, you have one unit test to say, yep, we did it, and then you move on. And it's never exercised ever again in the real world or anywhere else. So, like, that's the kind of place where you want to find vulnerabilities. And those are the kinds of vulnerabilities these are. They're like IP refragmentation vulnerabilities. They're like IP tunneling vulnerabilities, where you have like one kind of packet like stuffed into another packet, and then it's on the networking gear to extract it. You know, you can imagine like this is the kind of place also where you're going to find bugs. And that's exactly these kinds of bugs. And then the other thing is like a lot of this gear has been out there for a long time. It just kind of quietly runs and never breaks. And so it never gets fixed, right? You never see a patch. One side note to this whole adventure with Trek is that when they started down the path of like contacting their downstream, you know, customers saying like, hey, you know, we have these vulnerabilities, you want this patch? They're like, oh yeah, I forgot that we dealt with you 15 years ago. maybe we need a support contract now. So I think Trek ended up making some money out of this deal for wow. like re-upping support contracts and maintenance contracts. So good for them, I guess.
Yeah.
So note to other smaller networking companies, keep up with your customers and give them patches and they will remember to pay you.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a pretty cool success story. I like that one.
It's a nice side story, but the downside is that some of these downstream companies went out of business, right? Like, or got subsumed by somebody else, yeah. and then the products got end-of-lifed or whatever. For whatever yeah. reason, these things are never going to see a patch, ever. These are forever day kind of style bugs. So most of the time, as usual, you don't want to see these things on the open internet where anybody can just walk up and start throwing UDP packets at them. But
I like it. You make it sound as if it's like the packets of ketchup you get at McDonald's. You're just going to start loving them.
Yeah. I remember throwing UDP packets at passing cars as a youth.
Those were the days. Simpler times. Uh-huh.
Yep. But yeah, that generally you don't want to have happen, but of course it does by accident. And there's never going to be a patch. And so like the first warning, a lot of these like installation bases are going to get that they have a problem is that their thing just, you know, just up and died and they don't know why. Which is probably the best case that you just DOS them. Worst case, many of these have remote code execution vulnerabilities. So you can do things like install crummy little crypto miners on these things or, use them as like a beachhead. If you've gotten into the network some other way, then you can like stash your, you know, command and control on, you know, these goofy OT devices and things like that. So that's it. That's the story. So like every vendor into this. So basically, if you know that you're running somewhat specialized IoT, OT, SCADA, ICS gear, then take a look. Hopefully you know about it. If you don't know, it's fine. You can go scan your network. And it really shouldn't be on the internet. But if it is, don't worry. We found it for you. Come to opendata.rapid7.com and maybe it's lurking in there too. So that's the story of that bug. Do we have time for the other thing, for the Zoom update?
Oh, there's more on Zoom. You do love an opportunity to talk about your Zoom blog.
I do. So you should go see my Zoom blog. It's at, if you just Google Zoom bugbears, you'll find it.
The bugbear part is the important part.
Just real quick, Zoom announced, it was the 17th of June. Zoom announced that they will be rolling out end-to-end encryption for everyone, not just for paid customers. So this is a reversal from their initial plan that they weren't super talking about until a couple people noticed.
They weren't super talking about it when they were being selective on the customers that they were offering it to. Straight.
A little bit. Yeah. There were some unfortunate things said about working with law enforcement that seemed a little tone deaf, especially at the beginning of June.
Where they basically made it sound as if like warrants just don't apply to them.
Right. Yeah. It's like, oh, don't worry. We are incorporated in Gibraltar or something. And we have,
have a get out of Gibraltar card.
Yeah. They're not. They're incorporated in the US. This is a case of like Zoom does tend to do the right thing eventually. They do respond, which is derisive, but they do respond to like public pushback, right? Like, so making a stink about things on Twitter
for whatever reason, seems to work.
Yay! Power to the people.
Yeah, and I'm sure there was a lot of like side conversations, not on Twitter, but you know, there was some significant pushback, basically from all corners, saying like, you can't really offer EDE to one class of people and not the other, and not look like a jerk about it. It doesn't mean that you can't, and it doesn't mean that you can't have it as an upsell, and it doesn't
just accept that everyone's going to think you're a jerk, right?
You
right.
just might be a jerk, and that's the way it is. And they decided we don't want to be jerks quite yet, so they did roll that back. And so keep an eye out for that on one of the future updates, probably end of July.
So, but from memory, this is not the first time they've used the magical words end-to-end encryption. So, have we verified that it is in fact the real deal this time around?
It is, in fact, technically end-to-end encryption.
Technically. That's a good,
now, technically in this case is a good thing. it is not marketing-wise end-to-end encryption. It is technical end-to-end encryption.
It is real, live end-to-end encryption.
And if you don't believe me or them, you can go read their white paper. If you just Google around like Zoom E2E GitHub, I think you'll find it, because they published their white paper on GitHub. They continue to take issue. Like you can flag like certain parts of the text and say like this is wrong, and then you can say an issue. You can like open an issue, and they will respond to it. They do seem to be paying attention to that. The way they're doing it, like there's like corner cases where it's like, are you sure you want to do it that way? But that's like how technology.
I mean, to be fair, they have had, to the best of my understanding, they've had Matt Green working with them.
Yep.
And so if you botch encryption when you've got, I think Dr. Matt Green or Professor Matt
yes.
Green, Dr. Matt Green, who, you know, he knows a thing or two on this topic. He really does.
Yep.
So yeah, hopefully it's all good.
Of course, it all comes down to implementation details. That's how it goes with cryptography every time. Like you can write about it all day long, but it depends on like how the code is written. And so I have every expectation that everyone who does like cryptographic analysis on traffic is going to be pouring over this, because.
Yeah.
Everyone loves to beat up on Zoom, and like anytime they make a mistake, like
I mean, let's be fair, everyone loves to beat up on everyone. Zoom's just the flavor of the month.
Everyone loves to beat up on everyone, but if you beat up on Zoom, people pay attention. So
it's true. Insta headline.
Yes. What's the line like? If you let me kick your ass, I'll make you famous. Something like that. There's a famous line from like a boxer, or Bruce Lee, I believe, said that. and so that's that goes for Zoom.
How wide ranging our references are.
Yeah. So yes, get Bruce Lee on Zoom and people, and they'll fix it. And they'll tend to fix things pretty quick. Like the kinds of like responses they come back with are like I would expect from a similarly sized company to take 6 months, 9 months,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
to like really vet it out and like have a bunch of weasel words in it and like have like a real, you know, general counsel approved statement about it. But not Zoom. They tend to turn around on bad decisions
very quickly,
you know, in the space of like a week.
Well, credit to them. Yep, that is a good point. Mm-hmm. And you know, they have pulled in a lot of heavy hitters to help them and advise, so you know,
they
maybe
have pulled
they
in
will.
Every famous cryptographer there. Not
maybe
every
they
famous,
will raise Bruce Lee from the dead to
maybe all right kick this thing's ass and see what happens.
Anyway, thank you to Art for coming on and talking to us about
this. Thanks, Art, for fixing this Ripple stuff, this Ripple 20 stuff, too.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you to you for obviously enlightening me about all of these cool things. I now really want to go and eat some ice cream. And thank you to Bree for putting up with us, as per usual. Thanks, everyone, and until next thrilling episode.
Yep. Wear your mask. Stay safe.